Christ, Pa, what else do you give away?
His father peered over the teacup with a look of innocent surprise. It made him madder.
Figure it out. Just figure it out. Say you make 35 cents on 10 loaves. You take a bus up and back, and there's 25 cents shot. That leaves 10 cents. On top of that, there's an hour wasted. What are you running a business for? Your health?
Slup went the tea through his teeth. Slup, slup, slup.
Mama walks.
He sat there, looking at his son like a benevolent Buddha. Ichiro lifted up the cup to his lips and let the liquid burn down his throat. His father had said, "Mama walks," and that made things right with the world. The overwhelming simplicity of the explanation threatened to evoke silly giggles which, if permitted to escape, might lead to hysterics. He clenched his fists and subdued them. At the opposite end of the table, the father had slupped the last of his tea and was already taking the few steps to the sink to rinse out the cup.
"God damn it, Pa, sit down."
He'd never realized how nervous a man his father was. The old man had constantly been doing something every minute since he had come. It didn't figure. Here he was, round and fat and cheerful-looking, and yet he was going incessantly as though his trousers were crawling with ants.
"Ya, Ichiro, I forget you have just come home. We should talk."
He resumed his seat at the table and busied his fingers with a box of matches. Ichiro stepped out of the kitchen, spotted the cigarettes behind the cash register, and returned with a pack of Camels. Lighting a match, the old man held it between his fingers and waited until the son opened the package and put a cigarette in his mouth. By then, the match was threatening to sear his fingers. He dropped it hastily and stole a sheepish glance at Ichiro, who reached for the box and struck his own match.
"Ichiro."
There was a timorousness in the father's voice. Or was it apology?
"Yeah."
"Was it very hard?"
"No, it was fun."
The sarcasm didn't take.
"You are sorry?"
He was waddling over rocky ground on a pitch black night, and he didn't like it one bit.
"I'm okay, Pa. It's finished. Done and finished. No use talking about it."
"True," said the old man too heartily. "It is done, and there is no use to talk."
The bell tinkled, and he leaped from the chair and fled out of the kitchen. Using the butt of the first cigarette, Ichiro lit another. He heard his father's voice in the store.
"Mama! Ichiro! Ichiro is here!"
The sharp, lifeless tone of his mother's words flipped through the silence, and he knew that she hadn't changed. The bread must be put out. In other homes, mothers and fathers and sons and daughters rushed into hungry arms after weekend separations to find assurance in crushing embraces and loving kisses. The last time he saw his mother was over 2 years ago. He waited, seeing in the sounds of the rustling waxed paper the stiff, angular figure of the woman stacking the bread on the rack in neat, precise piles. His father came back into the kitchen with a little less bounce and began to wash the cups. She came through the curtains a few minutes after, a small, flat-chested, shapeless woman who wore her hair pulled back into a tight bun. Hers was the awkward, skinny body of a 13-year-old, which had dried and toughened through the many years following, but which had developed no further. He wondered how the two of them had ever gotten together long enough to have two sons.
"I am proud that you are back," she said. "I am proud to call you my son."
It was her way of saying that she had made him what he was, and that the thing in him which made him say no to the judge and go to prison for 2 years was the growth of a seed planted by the mother tree, and that she was the mother who had put this thing in her son, and that everything that had been done and said was exactly as it should have been, and that that was what made him her son, because no other would have made her feel the pride that was in her breast. He looked at his mother and swallowed with difficulty the bitterness that threatened to destroy the last fragment of understanding for the woman who was his mother and still a stranger, because in truth, he could not know what it was to be a Japanese who breathed the air of America and yet had never lifted a foot from the land that was Japan. "I've been talking with Pa," he said, not knowing or caring why, except that he had to say something.
"After a while, you and I, we will talk also."
She walked through the kitchen into the bedroom and hung her coat and hat in a wardrobe of cardboard which had come from Sears Roebuck. Then she came back to the kitchen and out into the store. The father gave him what was meant to be a knowing look and uttered softly,
"Doesn't like my not being in the store when she is out. I tell her the bell tinkles, but she does not understand."
"Hell's bells," he said in disgust. Pushing himself out of the chair violently, he strode into the bedroom and flung himself out on one of the double beds. Lying there, he wished the roof would fall in and bury forever the anguish which permeated his every pore. He lay there fighting with his burden, lighting one cigarette after another, and dropping ashes and butts purposely on the floor. It was the way he felt, stripped of dignity, respect, purpose, honor, all the things which added up to schooling and marriage and family and work and happiness. "It was the pleaser," he said to himself, with teeth clamped together to imprison the wild, meaningless, despairing cry which was forever straining inside of him. "Pa's okay, but he's a nobody. He's a goddamned, fat, grinning, spineless nobody. Ma is the rock that's always hammering, pounding, 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 in her unobtrusive, determined, fanatical way, until there's nothing left to call oneself. She's cursed me with her meanness and the hatred that you cannot see, but which is always hating. It was she who opened my mouth and made my lips move to sound the words which got me 2 years in prison and an emptiness that is more empty and frightening than the caverns of hell. She's killed me with her meanness and hatred, and I hope she's happy, because I'll never know the meaning of it again."
"Ichiro."
He propped himself up on an elbow and looked at her. She had hardly changed. Surely there must have been a time when she could smile, and yet he could not remember.
"Yeah?" "Lunch is on the table."
As he pushed himself off the bed and walked past her to the kitchen, she took broom and dustpan and swept up the mess he had made. There were eggs fried with soy sauce, sliced cold meat, boiled cabbage, and tea and rice. They all ate in silence, not even disturbed once by the tinkling of the bell. The father cleared the table after they had finished, and dutifully retired to watch the store. Ichiro had smoked 3 cigarettes before his mother ended the silence.
"You must go back to school."
He had almost forgotten that there had been a time before the war when he had actually gone to college for 2 years and studiously applied himself to courses in the engineering school. The statement staggered him. Was that all there was to it? Did she mean to sit there and imply that the 4 intervening years were to be casually forgotten and life resumed as if there had been no 4 years and no war and no Edo who had spit on him because of the thing he had done? "I don't feel much like going to school."
"What will you do?"
"I don't know."
"With an education, your opportunities in Japan will be unlimited. You must go and complete your studies."
"Ma," he said slowly. "Ma, I'm not going to Japan. Nobody's going to Japan. The war is over. Japan lost. Do you hear? Japan lost."
"You believe that?"
It was said in the tone of an adult asking a child, who was no longer a child if he really believed that Santa Claus was real.
Yes, I believe it. I know it. America is still here. Do you see the great Japanese army walking down the streets?
No. There is no Japanese army anymore.
The boat is coming, and we must be ready.
The boat?
Yes.
She reached into her pocket and drew out a worn envelope. The letter had been mailed from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and was addressed to a name that he did not recognize. Inside the envelope was a single sheet of flimsy rice paper, covered with intricate flourishes of Japanese characters.
What does it say?
She did not bother to pick up the letter.
To you who are a loyal and honorable Japanese, it is with humble and heartfelt joy that I relay this momentous message. Word has been brought to us that the victorious Japanese government is presently making preparations to send ships, which will return to Japan those residents in foreign countries who have steadfastly maintained their faith and loyalty to our emperor. The Japanese government regrets that the responsibilities arising from the victory compels them to delay the sending of the vessels. To be among the few who remain to receive this honor is a gratifying tribute. Heed not the propaganda of the radio and newspapers, which endeavor to convince the people with lies about the Allied victory. Especially, heed not the lies of your traitorous countrymen, who have turned their backs on the country of their birth, and who will suffer for their treasonous acts. The day of glory is close at hand. The rewards will be beyond our greatest expectations. What we have done only as Japanese. But the government is grateful. Hold your heads high and make ready for the journey, for the ships are coming.
Who wrote that? He asked incredulously. It was like a weird nightmare. It was like finding out that an incurable strain of insanity pervaded the family, an intangible horror that swayed and taunted beyond the grasp of reaching fingers.
A friend in South America. We are not alone.
We are alone, he said vehemently. This whole thing is crazy. You're crazy. I'm crazy. All right. So we made a mistake. Let's admit it.
There has been no mistake. The letter confirms.
Sure it does. It proves there's crazy people in the world besides us. If Japan won the war, what the hell are we doing here? What are you doing running a grocery store? It doesn't figure. It doesn't figure because we're all wrong. The minute we admit that, everything is fine. I've had a lot of time to think about all this. I've thought about it. And every time the answer comes out the same. You can't tell me different anymore. She sighed ever so slightly.
We will talk later when you are feeling better.
Carefully folding the letter and placing it back in the envelope, she returned it to her pocket.
It is not I who tell you that the ship is coming. It is in the letter. If you have come to doubt your mother, and I'm sure you do not mean it even if you speak in weakness, it is to be regretted. Rest a few days. Think more deeply, and your doubts will disappear. You are my son, Ichiro.
No, he said to himself, as he watched her part the curtains and start into the store. There was a time when I was your son. There was a time that I no longer remember, when you used to smile a mother's smile, and tell me stories about gallant and fierce warriors who protected their lords with blades of shining steel, and about the old woman who found a peach in the stream and took it home, and when her husband split it in half, a husky little boy tumbled out to fill their hearts with boundless joy. I was that boy in the peach, and you were the old woman, and we were Japanese, with Japanese feelings, and Japanese pride, and Japanese thoughts. Because it was all right then to be Japanese, and feel and think all the things that Japanese do, even if we lived in America. Then there came a time when I was only half Japanese, because one is not born in America and raised in America and taught in America, and one does not speak and swear and drink and smoke and play and fight and see and hear in America, among Americans, in American streets and houses, without becoming American and loving it. But I did not love enough, for you were still half my mother, and I was thereby still half Japanese. And when the war came, and they told me to fight for America, I was not strong enough to fight you, and I was not strong enough to fight the bitterness, which made the half of me which was you bigger than the half of me which was America, and really the whole of me that I could not see or feel. Now that I know the truth, when it is too late, and the half of me which was you is no longer there, I am only half of me, and the half that remains is American by law, because the government was wise and strong enough to know why it was that I could not fight for America, and did not strip me of my birthright. But it is not enough to be American only in the eyes of the law, and it is not enough to be only half an American and know that it is an empty half. I am not your son, and I am not Japanese, and I am not American. I can go someplace and tell people that I've got an inverted stomach and that I am an American, true and blue and hail Columbia, but the army wouldn't have me because of the stomach. That's easy, and I would do it. Only I've got to convince myself first, and that I cannot do. I wish with all my heart that I were Japanese or that I were American. I am neither, and I blame you, and I blame myself, and I blame the world, which is made up of many countries which fight with each other, and kill, and hate, and destroy, but not enough, so that they must kill, and hate, and destroy again, and again, and again. It is so easy and simple that I cannot understand it at all. And the reason I do not understand it is because I do not understand you, who are the half of me that is no more, and because I do not understand what it was about that half that made me destroy the half of me which was American, and the half which might have become the whole of me if I had said, yes, I will go and fight in your army, because that is what I believe and want and cherish and love. Defeatedly, he crushed the stub of a cigarette into an ashtray filled with many other stubs and reached for the package to get another. It was empty, and he did not want to go into the store for more, because he did not feel much like seeing either his father or his mother. He went into the bedroom and tossed and groaned and half slept. Hours later, someone shook him awake. It was not his mother, and it was not his father. The face that looked down at him in the gloomy darkness was his brother's. "Taro," he said softly, for he had hardly thought of him. "Yeah, it's me," said his brother, with unmistakable embarrassment. "I see you got out. How have you been?" He studied his brother, who was as tall as he, but skinnier. "Okay, it's time to eat." He started to leave. "Taro, wait." His brother stood framed in the light of the doorway and faced him. "How've you been?" he repeated. Then he added quickly for fear of losing him. "No, I said that before and I don't mean it the way it sounds. We've got things to talk about. Long time since we saw each other." "Yeah, it's been a long time." "How's school?" "Okay." "About through with high school?" "Next June." "What then? College?" "No, army." He wished he could see his face, the face of the brother who spoke to him as though they were strangers, because that's what they were. "You could get in a year or two before the draft," he heard himself saying in an effort to destroy the wall that separated them. "I read where you can take an exam now and get a deferment if your showing is good enough." A fellow's got to have all the education he can get, Taro. I don't want a deferment. I want in. Mano? Who cares? She won't like it. Doesn't matter. Why so strong about the army? Can't you wait? They'll come and get you soon enough. That isn't soon enough for me. What's your reason? He waited for an answer, knowing what it was and not wanting to hear it. Is it because of me? What I did? I'm hungry, his brother said, and turned into the kitchen. His mother had already eaten and was watching the store. He sat opposite his brother, who wolfed down the food without looking back at him. It wasn't more than a few minutes before he rose, grabbed his jacket off a nail on the wall, and left the table. The bell tinkled, and he was gone.
Don't mind him, said the father apologetically. Taro is young and restless. He's never home except to eat and sleep.
When does he study?
He does not.
Why don't you do something about it?
I tell him. Mama tells him. Makes no difference. It is the war that has made them that way. All the people say the same thing. The war and the camp life made them wild like cats and dogs. It is hard to understand.
Sure, he said. But he told himself that he understood, that the reason why Taro was not a son and not a brother was because he was young and American and alien to his parents, who had lived in America for 35 years without becoming less Japanese and could speak only a few broken words of English and write it not at all. And because Taro hated that thing in his elder brother which had prevented him from thinking for himself. And in his hate for that thing, he hated his brother, and also his parents, because they had created the thing with their eyes and hands and minds, which had seen and felt and thought as Japanese for 35 years in an America which they rejected as thoroughly as if they had never been a day away from Japan. That was the reason, and it was difficult to believe. But it was true, because he was the emptiness between the one and the other, and could see flashes of the truth that was true for his parents, and the truth that was true for his brother. Pa, he said.
Ya, Ichiro.
He was swirling a dishcloth in a pan of hot water, and working up suds for the dishes. What made you and Ma come to America?
Everyone was coming to America.
Did you have to come?
No. We came to make money.
Is that all?
Yeah. I think that was why we came.
Why to make money?
There was a man in my village who went to America and made a lot of money. And he came back and bought a big piece of land. And he was very comfortable. We came so we could make money and go back and buy a piece of land and be comfortable too.
Did you ever think about staying here and not going back?
No.
He looked at his father, who was old and bald and washing dishes in a kitchen that was behind a hole in the wall that was a grocery store. How do you feel about it
now? About what?
Going back.
We are going.
When?
Oh, pretty soon.
How soon?
Pretty soon.
There didn't seem to be much point in pursuing the question. He went out to the store and got a fresh pack of cigarettes. His mother was washing down the vegetable stand, which stood alongside the entrance. Her thin arms swabbed the green-painted wood with sweeping, vigorous strokes. There was a power in the wiry brown arms, a hard, blind, unreckoning force which coursed through veins of tough bamboo. When she had done her work, She carried the pail of water to the curb outside and poured it on the street. Then she came back to the store and into the living quarters and emerged once more, dressed in her coat and hat.
"Come, Ichiro," she said. "We must go and see Kumasaka-san and Ashida-san. They will wish to know that you are back."
The import of the suggested visits made him waver helplessly. He was too stunned to voice his protest. The Kumasakas and the Ashidas were people from the same village in Japan. The three families had been very close for as long as he could recall. Further, it was customary among the Japanese to pay ceremonious visits upon various occasions to families of close association. This was particularly true when a member of one of the families either departed on an extended absence or returned from an unusually long separation. Yes, he had been gone a long time, but it was such a different thing. It wasn't as if he had gone to war and returned safe and sound, or had been matriculating at some school in another city and come home with a sheepskin, summa cum laude. He scrabbled at the confusion in his mind for the logic of the crazy business and found no satisfaction.
"Papa!"
his mother shouted without actually shouting. His father hastened out from the kitchen, and Ichiro stumbled in blind fury after the woman who was only a rock of hate and fanatic stubbornness, and was therefore neither woman nor mother. They walked through the night and the city, a mother and son, thrown together for a while longer, because the family group is a stubborn one and does not easily disintegrate. The woman walked ahead, and the son followed, and no word passed between them. They walked 6 blocks, then 6 more, and still another 6, before they turned into a 3-story frame building. The Ishidas, parents and 3 daughters, occupied 4 rooms on the 2nd floor.
"Mama!"
screamed the 10-year-old who answered the knock.
"Mrs. Yamada!"
A fat, cheerful-looking woman rushed toward them, then stopped, flushed and surprised.
"Ichiro-san, you have come back."
He nodded his head and heard his mother say with unmistakable exultation,
"Today, Ashida-san. Just today he came home."
Urged by their hostess, they took seats in the sparsely furnished living room. Mrs. Ashida sat opposite them on a straight-backed kitchen chair and beamed.
"You have grown so much. It is good to be home, is it not, Ichiro-san?"
She turned to the 10-year-old, who gawked at him from behind her mother.
"Tell Reiko to get tea and cookies."
"She's studying, Mama."
"You mustn't bother,"
said his mother.
"Go now. I know she is only listening to the radio."
The little girl fled out of the room.
"It is good to see you again, Ichiro-san. You will find many of your young friends already here. All the people who said they would never come back to Seattle are coming back. It is almost like it was before the war. Akira-san, you went to school with him, I think. He is just back from Italy. And Watanabe-san's boy came back from Japan last month. It is so good that the war is over, and everything is getting to be like it was before."
"You saw the pictures?"
his mother asked.
"What pictures?"
"You have not been to the Watanabes?"
"Oh, yes, the pictures of Japan,"
she snickered.
"He is such a serious boy. He showed me all the pictures he had taken in Japan. He had many of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I told him that he must be mistaken, because Japan did not lose the war as he seems to believe, and that he could not have been in Japan to take pictures because, if he were in Japan, he would not have been permitted to remain alive. He protested and yelled so that his mother had to tell him to be careful, and then he tried to argue some more. But I asked him if he was ever in Japan before, and could he prove that he was actually there, and he said again to look at the pictures. And I told him that what must really have happened was that the army only told him he was in Japan when he was someplace else, and that it was too bad he believed the propaganda. Then he got so mad his face went white, and he said, "How do you know you're you? Tell me how you know you're you." If his mother had not made him leave the room, he might even have struck me. It is not enough that they must willingly take up arms against their uncles and cousins and even brothers and sisters, but they no longer have respect for the old ones. If I had a son and he had gone in the American army to fight Japan, I would have killed myself with shame. They know not what they do, and it is not their fault. It is the fault of the parents. I've always said that Mr. Watanabe was a stupid man, gambling and drinking the way he does. I am almost ashamed to call them friends.
Ichiro's mother looked at him with a look which said, "I am a Japanese, and you are my son, and have conducted yourself as a Japanese, and I know no shame such as other parents do, because their sons were not really their sons, or they would not have fought against their own people." He wanted to get up and dash out into the night. The madness of his mother was in mutual company, and he felt nothing but loathing for the gentle, kindly-looking Mrs. Ishida, who sat on a 50-cent chair from Goodwill Industries, while her husband worked the night shift at a hotel, grinning and bowing for dimes and quarters from rich Americans whom he detested, and couldn't afford to take his family on a bus ride to Tacoma, but was waiting and praying and hoping for the ships from Japan. Reiko brought in a tray holding teacups and a bowl of thin round cookies. She was around 17, with little bumps on her chest which the sweater didn't improve, and her lips heavily lipsticked a deep red. She said hi to him, and did not have to say, "Look at me. I was a kid when you saw me last, but now I'm a woman, with a woman's desires and a woman's eye for men like you." She set the tray on the table and gave him a smile before she left. His mother took the envelope from Sao Paulo out of her dress pocket and handed it to Mrs. Ishida. "From South America." The other woman snatched at the envelope and proceeded to read the contents instantly. Her face glowed with pride. She read it eagerly, her lips moving all the time and frequently murmuring audibly.
"Such wonderful news," she sighed breathlessly, as if the reading of the letter had been a deep emotional experience. "Mrs. Okamoto will be eager to see this. Her husband, who goes out of the house whenever I am there, is threatening to leave her unless she gives up her nonsense about Japan. Nonsense, he calls it. He is no better than a Chinaman. This will show him. I feel so sorry for her."
"It is hard when so many no longer believe," replied his mother. "But they are not Japanese like us. They only call themselves such. It is the same with the Teradas. I no longer go to see them. The last time I was there, Mr. Terada screamed at me and told me to get out. They just don't understand that Japan did not lose the war, because Japan could not possibly lose. I try not to hate them, but I have no course but to point them out to the authorities when the ships come."
"It's getting late, Ma." He stood up, sick in the stomach, and wanting desperately to smash his way out of the dishonest, warped, and uncompromising world in which defeated people like his mother and the Ishidas walked their perilous tightropes, and could not and would not look about them, for having to keep their eyes fastened to the taut, thin support.
"Yes," his mother replied quickly. "Forgive us for rushing, for you know that I enjoy nothing better than a visit with you, but we must drop in for a while on the Kumasakas."
"Of course. I wish you could stay longer, but I know that there will be plenty of opportunities again. You will come again, please, Ichiro-san."
Mumbling thanks for the tea, he nodded evasively and hurried down the stairs. Outside, he lit a cigarette and paced restlessly until his mother came out. A fine woman, she said without stopping. He followed, talking to the back of her head. Ma, I don't want to see the Kumasakas tonight. I don't want to see anybody tonight. We'll go some other time.
We won't stay long.
They walked a few blocks to a freshly painted frame house that was situated behind a neatly kept lawn.
Nice house, he said.
They bought it last month.
Bought it?
Yes.
The Kumasakas had run a dry cleaning shop before the war. Business was good, and people spoke of their having money. But they lived in cramped quarters above the shop because, like most of the other Japanese, they planned someday to return to Japan and still felt like transients even after 30 or 40 years in America. And the quarters above the shop seemed adequate and sensible since the arrangement was merely temporary. That, he thought to himself, was the reason why the Japanese were still Japanese. They rushed to America with the single purpose of making a fortune, which would enable them to return to their own country and live adequately. It did not matter when they discovered that fortunes were not for the mere seeking, or that their sojourns were spanning decades instead of years, and it did not matter that growing families and growing bills and misfortunes and illness and low wages and just plain hard luck were constant obstacles to the realization of their dreams. They continued to maintain their dreams by refusing to learn how to speak or write the language of America, and by living only among their own kind, and by zealously avoiding long-term commitments such as the purchase of a house. But now, the Kumasakas, it seemed, had bought this house, and he was impressed. It could only mean that the Kumasakas had exchanged hope for reality, and late as it was, were finally sinking roots into the land from which they had previously sought not nourishment, but only gold. Mrs. Kumasaka came to the door, a short, heavy woman who stood solidly on feet planted wide apart, like a man. She greeted them warmly, but with a sadness that she would carry to the grave. When Ichiro had last seen her, her hair had been pitch black. Now it was completely white. In the living room, Mr. Kumasaka, a small man with a pleasant smile, was sunk deep in an upholstered chair, reading a Japanese newspaper. It was a comfortable room with rugs and soft furniture and lamps and end tables and pictures on recently papered walls.
Ah, Ichiro, it is nice to see you looking well.
Mr. Kumasaka struggled out of the chair and extended a friendly hand.
Please, sit down.
You've got a nice place, he said, meaning it.
Thank you, the little man said. Mama and I, we finally decided that America is not so bad. We like it here.
Ichiro sat on the sofa next to his mother and felt strange in this home, which he envied because it was like millions of other homes in America and could never be his own. Mrs. Kumasaka sat next to her husband on a large round hassock and looked at Ichiro with lonely eyes, which made him uncomfortable.
Ichiro came home this morning.
It was his mother, and the sound of her voice, deliberately loud and almost arrogant, puzzled him.
He has suffered, but I make no apologies for him or for myself. If he had given his life for Japan, I could not be prouder.
Ma, he said, wanting to object, but not knowing why, except that her comment seemed out of place. Ignoring him, she continued, not looking at the man, but at his wife, who now sat with head bowed, her eyes emptily regarding the floral pattern of the carpet.
A mother's lot is not an easy one. To sleep with a man and bear a son is nothing. To raise the child into a man one can be proud of is not play. Some of us succeed. Some, of course, must fail. It is too bad, but that is the way of life. Yes, yes, Yamada-san, said the man impatiently.
Then smiling, he turned to Ichiro.
I suppose you'll be going back to the university?
I'll have to think about it, he replied, wishing that his father was like this man, who made him want to pour out the turbulence in his soul.
He will go when the new term begins. I have impressed upon him the importance of a good education.
With a college education, one can go far in Japan. His mother smiled knowingly.
Ah,
said the man, as if he had not heard her speak.
Bobby wanted to go to the university and study medicine. He would have made a fine doctor, always studying and reading. Is that not so, Ichiro?
He nodded, remembering the quiet son of the Kumasakas, who never played football with the rest of the kids on the street or appeared at dances, but could talk for hours on end about chemistry and zoology and physics and other courses which he hungered after in high school. Sure, Bob always was pretty studious. He knew, somehow, that it was not the right thing to say, but he added, Where is Bob? His mother did not move. Mrs. Kumasaka uttered a despairing cry and bit her trembling lips. The little man, his face a drawn mask of pity and sorrow, stammered,
Ichiro, you... No one has told you?
No. What? No one's told me anything.
Your mother did not write you.
No. Write about what? He knew what the answer was. It was in the whiteness of the hair of the sad woman who was the mother of the boy named Bob, and it was in the engaging pleasantness of the father, which was not really pleasantness, but a deep understanding which had emerged from resignation to a loss which only a parent knows and suffers. And then he saw the picture on the mantle, a snapshot, enlarged many times over, of a grinning youth in uniform who had not thought to remember his parents with a formal portrait because he was not going to die, and there would be worlds of time for pictures and books and other obligations of the living later on. Mr. Kumasaka startled him by shouting toward the rear of the house,
June, please come.
There was a sound of a door opening, and presently there appeared a youth in khaki shirt and wool trousers, who was a stranger to Ichiro.
I hope I haven't disturbed anything, June, said Mr. Kumasaka.
No, it's all right, just writing a letter.
This is Mrs. Yamada and her son Ichiro. They are old family friends.
June nodded to his mother and reached over to shake Ichiro's hand. The little man waited until June had seated himself on the end of the sofa.
June is from Los Angeles. He's on his way home from the army and was good enough to stop by and visit us for a few days. He and Bobby were together. Buddies, is that what you say?
That's right,
said June.
Now, June.
Yes?
The little man looked at Ichiro and then at his mother, who stared stonily at no one in particular.
June, as a favor to me, although I know it is not easy for you to speak of it, I want you to tell us about Bobby.
June stood up quickly.
Gosh, I don't know.
He looked with tender concern at Mrs. Kumasaka.
It is all right, June. Please, just this once more.
Well, okay.
He sat down again, rubbing his hands thoughtfully over his knees.
The way it happened, Bobby and I, we had just gotten back to the rest area. Everybody was feeling good because there was a lot of talk about the Germans surrendering. All the fellows were cleaning their equipment. We'd been up in the lines for a long time, and everything was pretty well messed up. When you're up there getting shot at, you don't worry much about how crummy your things get. but the minute you pull back, they got to have inspection. So we were cleaning things up. Most of us were cleaning our rifles, because that's something you learn to want to do, no matter how anything else looks. Bobby was sitting beside me, and he was talking about how he was going to medical school and become a doctor.
A sob wrenched itself free from the breast of the mother, whose son was once again dying, and the snow-white head bobbed wretchedly.
"Go on, June," said the father.
June looked away from the mother and at the picture on the mantle.
Bobby was like that. Me and the other guys, all we talked about was drinking and girls and stuff like that, because it's important to talk about those things when you make it back from the front on your own power. But Bobby, all he thought about was going to school. I was nodding my head and saying, "Yeah, yeah." And then there was this noise, kind of a pinging noise right close by. It scared me for a minute, and I started to cuss and said, "Gee, that was damn close," and looked around at Bobby. He was slumped over with his head between his knees. I reached out to hit him, thinking he was fooling around. Then, when I tapped him on the arm, he fell over, and I saw the dark spot on the side of his head where the bullet had gone through. That was all. Ping, and he's dead. It doesn't figure, but it happened just the way I said.
The mother was crying now, without shame, and alone in her grief that knew no end. And in her bottomless grief that made no distinction as to what was wrong and what was right, and who was Japanese and who was not. There was no awareness of the other mother with a living son, who had come to say to her, "You are with shame and grief because you were not Japanese, and thereby killed your son. But mine is big and strong and full of life, because I did not weaken and would not let my son destroy himself uselessly and treacherously." Ichiro's mother rose and, without a word, for no words would ever pass between them again, went out of the house, which was a part of America. Mr. Kumasaka placed a hand on the rounded back of his wife, who was forever beyond consoling, and spoke gently to Ichiro.
"You don't have to say anything. You are truly sorry, and I am sorry for you."
"I didn't know," he said pleadingly.
"I want you to feel free to come and visit us whenever you wish. We can talk even if your mother's convictions are different."
"She's crazy. Mean and crazy. Goddamn Jap." He felt the tears, hot and stinging.
"Try to understand her."
Impulsively, he took the little man's hand in his own and held it briefly. Then he hurried out of the house, which could never be his own. His mother was not waiting for him. He saw her tiny figure strutting into the shadows away from the illumination of the streetlights and did not attempt to catch her. As he walked up one hill and down another, not caring where, and only knowing that he did not want to go home, he was thinking about the Kumasakas and his mother and kids like Bob, who died brave deaths fighting for something which was bigger than Japan or America, or the selfish bond that strapped a son to his mother. Bob, and a lot of others with no more to lose or gain than he, had not found it necessary to think about whether or not to go in the army. When the time came, they knew what was right for them, and they went. What had happened to him and the others who faced the judge and said, "You can't make me go in the army, because I'm not an American, or you wouldn't have plucked me and mine from a life that was good and real and meaningful, and fenced me in the desert like they do the Jews in Germany. And it is a puzzle why you haven't started to liquidate us, though you might as well, since everything else has been destroyed." And some said, "You, Mr. Judge, who supposedly represent justice, was it a just thing to ruin 100,000 lives? And homes and farms and businesses and dreams and hopes, because the 100,000 were 100,000 Japanese, and you couldn't have loyal Japanese
when Japan is the country you're fighting? And if so, how about the Germans and Italians that must be just as questionable as the Japanese, or we wouldn't be fighting Germany and Italy? Round them up, take away their homes and cars and beer and spaghetti, and throw them in a camp. And what do you think they'll say when you try to draft them into your army, of the country that is for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? If you think we're the same kind of rotten Japanese that dropped the bombs on Pearl Harbor, and it's plain that you do, or I wouldn't be here having to explain to you why it is that I won't go and protect sons of bitches like you, I say you're right, and bonsai three times, and we'll sit the war out in a nice cell, thank you. And then another one got up and faced the judge and said meekly, I can't go because my brother is in the Japanese army, and if I go in your army and have to shoot at them because they're shooting at me, how do I know that maybe I won't kill my own brother? I'm a good American, and I like it here. But you can see that it wouldn't do for me to be shooting at my own brother. Even if he went back to Japan when I was 2 years old and couldn't know him if I saw him, it's the feeling that counts. And what can a fellow do? Besides, my mom and dad said I shouldn't, and they ought to know. And after the fellow with the brother in the army of the wrong country sat down, a tall, skinny one sneered at the judge and said, I'm not going in the army, because wool clothes give me one hell of a bad time, and them OD things you make the guys wear will drive me nuts, and I'd end up shooting bastards like you, which would be too good, but then you'd only have to shoot me, and I like living, even if it's in striped trousers, as long as they aren't wool. The judge, who looked Italian and had a German name, repeated the question as if the tall, skinny one hadn't said anything yet. And the tall, skinny one tried again, only this time he was serious. He said, I got it all figured out. Economics, that's what. I hear this guy with the stars, the general of your army that cleaned the Japs off the coast, got $1 million for the job. All this bull about us being security risks and saboteurs and Shinto freaks, that's for the birds and the dumbheads. The only way it figures is the money angle. How much did they give you, Judge? Or aren't your fingers long enough? Cut me in. Give me a cut, and I'll go fight your war single-handed. Please, Judge, said the next one. I want to go in your army, because this is my country, and I've always lived here, and I was all city guard, and one time I wrote an essay for composition about what it means to me to be an American, and the teacher sent it into a contest, and they gave me $25, which proves that I'm a good American. Maybe I look Japanese, and my father and mother and brothers and sisters look Japanese, but we're better Americans than the regular ones, because that's the way it has to be when one looks Japanese, but is really a good American. We're not like the other Japanese, who aren't good Americans like us. We're more like you and the other regular Americans. All you have to do is give us back our home and grocery store and let my kid brother be all city like me. Nobody has to know. We can be Chinese. We'll call ourselves Qin or Yang or something like that, and it'll be the best thing you've ever done, sir. That's all. A little thing. Will you do that for one good, loyal American family? We'll forget the 2 years in camp, because anybody can see it was all a mistake. And you didn't really mean to do it, and I'm all yours. There were others with reasons just as flimsy and unreal, and they had all gone to prison, where the months and years softened the unthinking bitterness and let them see the truth when it was too late. For the one who could not go, because Japan was the country of his parents' birth, there were 1,000 Bobs who had gone into the army with a singleness of purpose. In answer to the tall, skinny one who spouted economics, another 1,000 with even greater losses had answered the greetings. For each and every refusal, based on sundry reasons, another 1,000 chose to fight for the right to continue to be Americans, because homes and cars and money could be regained, but only if they first regained their rights as citizens. And that was everything. And then Ichiro thought to himself, my reason was all the reasons put together. I did not go because I was weak and could not do what I should have done. It was not my mother, whom I have never really known. It was me, myself. It is done, and there can be no excuse. I remember Kenzo, whose mother was in the hospital and did not want him to go. The doctor told him that the shock might kill her. He went anyway, the very next day, because though he loved his mother, he knew that she was wrong. And she did die. And I remember Harry, whose father had a $1 million produce business, and the old man just boarded everything up because he said he'd rather let the trucks and buildings and warehouses rot than sell them for a quarter of what they were worth. Harry didn't have to stop and think when his number came up. Then there was Mr. Yamaguchi, who was almost 40 and had 5 girls. They would never have taken him, but he had to go and talk himself into a uniform. I remember a lot of people and a lot of things now as I walk confidently through the night over a small span of concrete, which is part of the sidewalks, which are part of the city, which is part of the state and the country and the nation that is America. It is for this that I meant to fight. Only the meaning got lost when I needed it most badly. Then he was on Jackson Street and walking down the hill. Through the windows of the drugstore, the pool hall, the cafes and taverns, he saw groups of young Japanese wasting away the night, as nights were meant to be wasted by young Americans with change in their pockets and a thirst for Cokes and beer and pinball machines or fast cars and deluxe hamburgers and cards and dice and trim legs. He recognized a face, a smile, a gesture or a sneer. But they were not for him, for he walked on the outside, and familiar faces no longer meant friends. He walked quickly, guiltily avoiding a chance recognition of himself by someone who remembered him. Minutes later, he was pounding on the door of the darkened grocery store with Home in the back. It was almost 12 o'clock, and he was surprised to see his father weave toward the door, fully dressed, and fumble with the latch. He smelled the liquor as soon as he stepped inside. He had known that his father took an occasional drink, but he'd never seen him drunk, and it disturbed him.
"Come in, come in," said the father thickly, moments after Ichiro was well inside.
After several tries, his father flipped the latch back into place. "I thought you'd be in bed, Pa." The old man stumbled toward the kitchen.
"Waiting for you, Ichiro. Your first night home. I want to put you to bed."
"Sure, sure. I know how it is." They sat down in the kitchen, the bottle between them. It was half empty. On the table was also a bundle of letters. By the cheap, flimsy quality of the envelopes, he knew that they were from Japan. One of the letters was spread out before his father, as if he might have been interrupted while perusing it.
"Ichiro."
His father grinned kindly at him. "Yeah?"
"Drink. You have got to drink a little to be a man, you know."
"Sure, Pa." He poured the cheap blend into a water glass and took a big gulp.
"God,"
he managed to say, with the liquor burning a deep rut all the way down.
"How can you drink this stuff?" "Only the first one or two is bad. After that, it gets easier."
Ichiro regarded the bottle skeptically. "You drink all this?"
"Yes, tonight."
"That's quite a bit."
"Yeah, but I finish."
"What are you celebrating?"
"Life."
"What?"
"Life. One celebrates Christmas and New Year's and 4th of July. That is all right. but life I can celebrate any time. I celebrate life.
Not bothering with a glass, he gurgled from the bottle. What's wrong, Pa? The old man waved his arm in a sweeping gesture.
Nothing is wrong, Ichiro. I just celebrate you. You are home. And is it wrong for me to be happy? Of course not. I am happy. I celebrate.
Things pretty tough?
No, no. We don't get rich, but we make enough.
What do you do with yourself?
Do?
Yeah. I remember you used to play Go with Mr. Kumasaka all the time. And Ma was always making me run after you to the Tondos. You were never home before the war. You still do those things?
Not so much.
You go and visit them?
Once in a while.
He watched his father, who was fiddling with the letter and avoiding his gaze. Many people think Japan won the war?
Not so many.
What do you think?
No.
Why?
I read, I hear, I see.
Why don't you tell Ma?
The old man looked up suddenly, and Ichiro thought that he was going to burst out with laughter. Just as quickly, he became soberly serious. He held up the thick pile of letters.
Your mama is sick, Ichiro. And she has made you sick. And I am sick because I cannot do anything for her. And maybe it is I that is somehow responsible for her sickness in the first place. These letters are from my brothers and cousins and nephews, and people I hardly knew in Japan 35 years ago. And they are from your mama's brother and two sisters, and cousins and friends, and uncles and people she does not remember at all. They all beg for help, for money and sugar, and clothes, and rice and tobacco, and candy, and anything at all. I read these letters, and drink, and cry, and drink some more, because my own people are suffering so much, and there is nothing I can do.
Why don't you send them things?
Your mama is sick, Ichiro. She says these letters are not from Japan, that they were not written by my brothers or her sisters or our uncles and nephews and nieces and cousins. She does not read them anymore. Propaganda, she says. She won't let me send money or food or clothing because she says it's all a trick of the Americans and that they will take them. I can send without her knowing, but I do not. It is not for me to say that she is wrong, even if I know so.
The father picked up the bottle and poured the liquor into his throat. His face screwed up, and tears came to his eyes. I'm going to sleep, Pa. Ichiro stood up and looked for a long time at his drunken father, who could not get drunk enough to forget.
Ichiro.
Yeah.
His father mumbled to the table.
I am sorry that you went to prison for us.
Sure. Forget it. He went to the bedroom, undressed in the dark, and climbed into bed, wondering why his brother wasn't sleeping. 2. There is a period between each night and day, when one dies for a few hours, neither dreaming nor thinking, nor tossing nor hating nor loving, but dying for a little while, because life progresses in just such a way. From that sublime depth, a stranger awakens to strain his eyes into focus on the walls of a strange room. Where am I? He asks himself. There is a fleeting sound of lonely panic as he juggles into order the heavy, sleep-laden pieces of his mind's puzzle. He is frightened because the bed is not his own. He is in momentary terror because the walls are clean and bare, and because the sounds are not the sounds of home, and because the chill air of a hotel room, 15 stories above the street, is not the same as the furry, stale warmth of a bedroom occupied by three and pierced by the life-giving fragrance of bacon and eggs sizzling in a pan down below.